Now you have large corporations and the executives of large corporations who are very much involved in the whole issue of assuring that they have business. Well, for example, the whole AWACS affair that you may recall. In that particular instance, you had the chief executives of many, many large firms who lobbied overtly on behalf of Saudi Arabia and giving the AWACS planes to Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. You remember the Whitaker Corporation, and there were a number of others. So you look around, you have most of the major corporations who were favoring business with the Arabs. And to the Whitaker Corporation, for example, it meant their lifeblood because they had over $500 million worth of business per year from Saudi Arabia, and so they wanted to make them well sure that they that Saudi Arabia was happy with them.
But you couldn't really call that anti-Semitism then, in that particular case, a big organization whose future is at stake if they get the order or don't get the order for Saudi Arabia. Can we be...
Well, I'm saying that it's a different basis.
That's
it's
what
an
I mean.
Economic.
Right.
Its origin, I think, to a large degree is economic, whereas previously its origin to a large degree
right.
was religious.
That clarifies.
But it is anti-Semitism, as far as I'm concerned, nevertheless, because it does. They are prejudiced against Israel, against Jews, and against Zionists.
And there is no question about that. Dr. Shapiro, you talk about anti-Semitism when you were a little boy. When you were in college, did you also encounter it?
Well, yes. You may recall that during the Depression, and I was a Depression baby, I guess. I was a Depression child, at least. It was difficult to get into schools, and it was also very difficult to get jobs, particularly Jews. I did go to Hopkins for two reasons, I guess. One, I had a cousin who preceded me there by a couple of years who told me how great it was. And two, I did get a scholarship while I was there for my first year. And three, I was accepted.
Which wasn't easy.
Well, I was in a little better position. I was a valedictorian of my class, so in high school. So I had a few more choices than other people. But I decided I was going to go to major in chemistry. So my chemistry teacher, who was a young fellow, as a matter of fact, who this was his first job, called me into his office toward the end of the year, and we talked about what my goals were. And at that time, he pointed out to me that it was extremely difficult, if not next to impossible, for a Jew to get a position in chemistry because the large corporations were not accepting Jews. And he said to me, you really have two choices. The probability is you'll not get a job in a corporation. So you either have to go into business for yourself, or you might possibly get a job as a professorial job. Well, professorial jobs were not very abundant at that time either. It was only after the beginning of the war, this was in 38, it was only after 38, 39, it was only after the beginning of the war, and there was a shortage of people, that things broke open, and everybody was accepted under those circumstances. Jews were able then to get jobs, whereas previously they were not able to get jobs. But that didn't mean that there wasn't anti-Semitism. In spite of what he told me, I decided that I would go ahead with it. I had an uncle who lived in Washington and worked for the Department of Agriculture, who was a chemist. And he was my favorite uncle, and he probably had a good deal to do with why I went into chemistry, in addition to my general inclinations. But in any event, I recall after I graduated, and this was in 42, my bachelor's, I went to went looking for a job. And one of the places where I was interviewed was the Naval Research Laboratory at Anacostia. And I was interviewed by the department head, who offered me a job. And he said that he wanted me to meet the director to confirm this. That's another thing I'll never forget. We went into the director's office. He asked me my name, you know. And then he started to talk about the difficulty of living in Washington. Was I able to... Did I know that it would be extremely difficult to find a place to live in Washington? It'd be next to impossible. And I told him, well, I do have an uncle in Washington, and I thought that I might be able to live there if I wasn't able to find a room. So he wanted to know who my uncle was, where he worked, and so on and so forth. And one thing led to another. Well, the end result of this whole thing was that he saw to it that I was not made an offer after that. And it was quite obvious that the whole thing revolved around the fact that I was Jewish. And this was a government laboratory. It was 1942. You know, we had gone into war and so on. So in spite of the fact that there were openings in certain places, because of the fact it hadn't yet gotten to the point where they were desperate for people, and this guy was being very picky as to whether when it came to Jew versus Gentile. So I never got that job, and I remember I was absolutely crushed. I went back and I called my uncle and asked him what I should do under the circumstances, and he suggested that I ought to talk to one of the professors who worked at Hopkins, who was a laboratory mate of his in the government before he accepted the job at Hopkins in the as a professor, which I did. His name was Emmett. And I talked to him and I told him what had occurred, and he then told me that this is not unusual, that it occurs all the time, I have to expect it, and that anti-Semitism in the government is rife, and in the universities, and certainly in the corporations, and that I would have a hard time, and that I'd better get used to it. Well, it didn't help very much. Well, to make a long story short, I finally got a job at the university itself doing defense research. Specifically, I was involved in studying the erosion of gun barrels. You know, I don't know whether you know anything about this, but large cannon on naval vessels could only shoot a couple of hundred shells before they had to be removed and replaced because the interior, the barrel of the gun, was eroded so badly that they couldn't shoot accurately. And this was a very serious problem during the war because you have ships at sea, they had to come in to be refitted after any major battle.
Yeah.
So it was a very serious problem, and I worked for a guy named Professor Fraser at the time. What brings to mind a lot of interesting things. But anyway, I worked for Professor Fraser, who was charged with the responsibility of that particular project. I worked between 42 and 45.
Did he object to working with the Jew? Or was he glad to have your ability?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I was a fresh graduate and with a bachelor's degree, and I remember he interviewed me after I had been given the job. This was my first day, and the fellow who was the project manager who reported to him had not yet come in, you know, it was a university, and so he took the opportunity of talking to me to try to explain what this whole project was all about, and he asked me whether I knew anything about carbonyl chemistry. Carbonyl chemistry. I had no idea what carbonyls were, let alone anything about carbonyl chemistry. And he looked at me as though I were an absolute idiot. Think about carbonyl chemistry. And I think he had resolved at that time that I must have been pretty stupid. But since I'd been offered a job, I guess I better be given an opportunity. Well, what happened was that he turned out to be a great guy, and was extremely friendly, and as a matter of fact, helped me out a good deal, because there was another professor who was a real anti-Semite whose course I had to take, and there was also some politics between the head of the department and Professor Fraser, who used to be the head of the department. So anybody who worked for Professor Fraser was automatically in trouble.
You get it from both ends.
Universities are not very pleasant places. They just use sharper daggers when they stick them between your ribs.
So you worked there all through World War II, is that right?
I worked there through... Yes, from 42 to 45.
And how were things during the war? How was the atmosphere during that period?
I don't know how to answer the question. I'm not quite sure what atmosphere in what respect.
Well, I was in the war for those years, and I wondered, too, if people would want to know, how was the economy? How were things in the Jewish community? What did happen during those particular years at home while the war was going on in Europe?
I really wasn't in much of a position to... first of all, I was really not integrated into the Jewish community.
Well, you weren't married at that period?
No, I was not married. I married in 45. I wasn't really integrated into the Jewish community. I was not active in any Jewish affairs, and I really can't say very much about the welfare of the mm-hmm. Jewish community during that period, although there were some, as I recall, who did extremely well, those who had the foresight to stock up certain things in anticipation of the war.
In other words, there were shortages.
That wasn't necessarily the Jewish community, though.
Yeah, there were shortages, and there were people who anticipated that things were going to get worse, and so they stocked up on all sorts of things, and of course the prices shot up compared to what they are today. They were nothing.
Mm-hmm. But can I ask a question about your uncle? You say he was a chemist with the government.
Yes.
Yet you said at the time it was difficult to get for a Jew to become part of the government.
Well, there were very few Jews in the government.
In other words, he was one of very, very few.
He was one.
Is that a generalization?
And I wouldn't say that as a generalization either. The government is very large, and there are lots of departments in it. He worked for the Department of Agriculture. He did have. There was no question that there was prejudice, but he started out in World War I, you see. He was a veteran in World War I, and then subsequently he went to Muscle Shoals, which was a government installation, and it was from Muscle Shoals, which was in North Tennessee. I think it's in the south. And he went from Muscle Shoals and he came to Washington, so it was a transfer in connection with his war efforts.
In other words, he didn't have to buck it as you did.
But in all...
Well, he did, in fact,
in
because it was an issue of getting improvement in position.
In all fairness, would you like to comment on the fact that during those crucial years you're speaking about, the atomic bomb was being developed at Los Alamos, and there were many Jews, Oppenheimer, Edward Teller, quite a few Jews that were active in the development of the atom bomb. Well, in other words, they were working for the government.
Well, as I said, you know, things opened up tremendously during the period of the war, because they weren't able to get enough scientists. Even when I came to Pittsburgh in 42, what am I saying, in 48, in 48, you know, the Westinghouse organization was not known for employing Jews. But there were pockets. For example, if you went to East Pittsburgh, you would hardly find a Jew. But if you went to the research laboratory, there were quite a few Jews. And that was dependent entirely upon the director, the head of, and what his own feelings and inclinations were with respect to the whole issue of Jews and anti-Semitism and so on. In the case of the research laboratory, it was an entirely different thing. Now, it turned out that the offer that I had gotten at Westinghouse was primarily as a result of one of the professors at Johns Hopkins, who left Johns Hopkins to work for Westinghouse, who subsequently made me an offer at the research laboratory. But I had other offers too in 48, because things had opened up significantly in terms of opportunities. Got an offer from DuPont. Would you believe that?
Right, but wouldn't you feel too that Jews excelled in the sciences and were recognized? For example, the laboratories.
Well, of course.
Used them for their skill.
Well, in the laboratories, you found that they were, there was a large number of them, and of course, those people that you point up were, to a large degree, refugees. I mean, if you're talking about Teller and you're talking about
Hungarians, they came here for that purpose, to get involved in the laboratories.
They didn't come with the purpose of necessarily getting involved in an atomic bomb.
No, but to get involved in research.
Well, they came here to escape Nazism.
Yeah.
And most of them went to universities. They continued their efforts. I mean, Teller was a professor I think he was a professor at Georgetown University.
Well, so was Oppenheimer, for that matter. Berkeley.
Well, they were all, right? Well, they were professors for the most part. But what they did was, they went from academic institutions in Europe and they came to the States.
To escape Nazism.
To escape Nazism, certainly.
Right. We want to get that on the record.
What would you like to know?
Well, I'd like to know where you went. You came to work for Westinghouse.
I came to work for Westinghouse and I went to the research laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the ceramics laboratory. And a few months after I came, Westinghouse was selected as the contractor for the development of the nuclear submarine reactor. And they were recruiting people at Westinghouse as well as outside. And I was one of the first half dozen or so people who was selected to go over to the Bettis laboratory to work on this project. And it was a rather exciting project. Everybody there was absolutely dedicated to it. Conditions weren't the greatest because we worked in a hangar, and it was, I remember we started working in that hangar in April and it was cold as hell. You couldn't warm up, you know, and we were working with our overcoats, gloves, and rubbers in order to keep warm. But everybody was very, very dedicated and very happy with what they were doing, including myself. And the result was that I used to spend a tremendous amount of time on the work. I worked essentially 7 days a week. And certainly far more than 8 hours. Now, this was between 1949, and I was there from 49, February of 49 it was, that I started, and I worked there until February of 1957, when I quit. Went into business for myself. But what had happened at that time was that we had no concept, no idea as to how we were going to build this, really. And there was a great deal of formula of thinking with regard to what conceptual thinking was, what it should be. And finally, they decided they were going to build this reactor of zirconium, which was a metal which was very little known at the time. As a chemist, I was put in charge of chemical metallurgy work, and since zirconium was very little known, it was also hard to get, and that which was, it was extremely expensive. As a matter of fact, it was, the material sold for somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,500 a pound, and you couldn't very well build a nuclear submarine which had thousands of pounds of this material with material that cost $1,500 a pound. And furthermore, the material was very unpredictable in its behavior. See, one of the things that the zirconium, incidentally, is an element, and just like iron is an element, copper, etc. The reason they selected zirconium was that this material was supposed to be resistant, corrosion resistant, in the environment in which it was to operate, and this was high pressure water, and it also was transparent to neutrons. You know anything about?
I just finished Edward Teller's book on neutrons.
Well, all right. Basically, what you have to do is to set up a chain reaction. Mm-hmm. And a chain reaction operates as a result of the fact that when neutrons hit a uranium atom, a fissionable uranium atom, uranium-235, that it breaks in part, roughly, elements. It fissions into two or more elements of roughly equal size, and it gives off two or more neutrons. Okay. So when one neutron hits and causes a fission with two neutrons, those two neutrons cause fission, and so you get four neutrons, and so on and so forth. So it builds up very, very rapidly, and that's called a chain reaction. Well, in order to have this chain reaction sustained, you needed to have a material from which you constructed this nuclear reactor, which would not absorb the neutrons and pull them out of the reaction, because if you did that, you wouldn't have a chain reaction. Well, zirconium, which was the material of choice, was transparent to neutrons. It also appeared to be resistant to corrosion in this environment. So that was the material of choice for the construction of this reactor. Well, because of my background, I was asked to head up the program for, one, determining how to make the material in quantity so that we could bring the price down, and also to make it pure and do it reliably and so on, so that its behavior would be consistent during its operation, so that instead of some material used to come in and you put it in hot water and it used to fall apart into a white powder. Well, obviously that's no good. So you had to have material which you knew was going to be consistently good. So that was the first project that I worked on. And I was responsible for developing this technique for producing zirconium for the first first submarine. And I developed the process and was responsible for the design and construction of the plant for the manufacture of the material.
Do you have any patents?
No, I have a lot of patents. I have 16.
Well, let's talk about your patents. I think that's exciting.
Well, the patents pertain to a number of things.
In that field, the field you're discussing.
And some outside of that field as well.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I have a number of patents that grew out of this activity.
I see.
And I was awarded, as a result of this work, the Westinghouse Silver W, which is their order of merit, given to what's supposed to be the highest order of merit for the Westinghouse for whatever. And I guess I was the youngest guy that had ever been awarded an order.
How old were you then at that time?
Well, let's see. I was awarded the thing in 1953. So I had been I was working from 48 to 53, and I guess I was 33 years old.
Yeah, that one I could count. I would assume that you were one of the few Jews that ever got that award, too.
Maybe at Westinghouse.
Up until that time, anyway.
I don't know.
Jews were getting awards in the West.
I don't really
on
know.
The other developments.
I know I was the youngest who had ever been, and I had been with Westinghouse only 5 years, so actually less than 5 years.
I'm curious, though. You said you were a chemist, and yet you developed the housing, not just the chemical aspect of the thing.
I was responsible for the development of the process as a chemical process for the production of this ultra pure metal.
Oh, I misunderstood what you said.
Okay,
now I understand.
And for the design of the equipment and plant associated with.
And this
well, but then that's design as well as chemistry.
Well, yeah, so you get to do a lot of things.
Right. This was all for the nuclear submarine?
This was all for the nuclear submarine.
I see.
All right, you
did you ever meet Rick Over?
Many times.
Really? What was he like? He was Jewish, wasn't he?
Yes, he was Jewish.
But did he practice it?
Not at that time. He was a bastard of the First Order.
I've heard that.
Really?
This is not the first time.
Why do you say he didn't practice Judaism at that time? Did he subsequently or before?
Well, he's admitted more to his Judaism and has been involved and has accepted awards from Jewish organizations, whereas previously he distanced himself from it, although he said that many of his difficulties with the Navy were due to the fact that he was a Jew and that there was anti-Semitism. He was a graduate of the Naval Academy.
Of Annapolis.
In Annapolis, and as a result of the fact that he was a Jew, he felt that he was